Hello and welcome to recording number 26 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. It is July 5th, 2021. I'm going to start here on page 191, paragraph 2. Lord, what are you doing? Heavily on hands and knees, was looking sideways in his direction, over her shoulder. Stop poking around in those dirty old tatters and help me. I think I have our way out. George shook away his horror and disgust, surreptitiously wiped his blade on a bit of the rags, and slipped the dagger back into its sheath as he advanced across the cell. What have you found? He replied, pretending nothing had happened, as he picked up the lantern from the center of the chamber and moved closer. Here, cried the girl. The exit is right here. You're right, dear Gord, my rescuer. The place was easy to find. Gord peered at the spot she was pointing to, holding the lantern close, and willing his hand not to shake. The entire episode with the rag thing had consumed only a few seconds of time, but the memory of it would last much longer. After a few seconds of careful scrutiny, Gord managed to make out faint scratches on the edge of a block that protruded slightly from the wall. On his own, it would have taken him hours to detect these marks, unless he was very lucky and caught the striations just so in a good light. Heavily had not had the benefit of such illumination. Gord looked at the girl with new respect. Perhaps the tales he had heard about elven eyesight were true, in which case, thank gods for her heritage. Well, there's a little bit of humor there, with Gord doing this and then Evelyn not even noticing the fight that just was going on behind her. And we have Gord feeling that he would not have noticed, even though looking directly for the scratches showing about a secret door or secret entrance or something here, and that Evelyn notices it after a very short time. And there is the comment that she probably does have that elven heritage. I wasn't sure if detect traps was part of the norm for... I didn't think it was... Is that part of the 1E?
Yeah, so, I think Find Traps is part of the 1E Thieves Toolkit.
Oh, no, but was it part of the Elven abilities?
No, I don't think so. They get, like, plus one with short swords and immune to charm and sleep or stuff like that.
I know. Yeah, I think, what is it, dwarves have... slanting corridors or something.
Yeah, they
like
can
that.
Detect the gradient in a tunnel. I think elves might get that too, though.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure about like secret door detection or trap detection, because obviously that's what they're referring to with that kind of idea.
Right.
All right. So I just wanted to know, especially because that little bit that's supposed to be humorous right there. With Evelyn not even noticing the fight going on behind her.
Yeah.
All right.
Maybe she's focused on whatever it is she's doing.
Yeah. And one thing to note is that Gygax does mention that Gord cleans his blade. And that was something I see. You know, it's not something that's very picayune, but it's something I see mostly like in movies. Where, you know, somebody will go through a big fight and then just sheath their blade, but which would mean that the sheath would be, you know, the interior of the sheath is like either wood or leather. You know, it's not like just a sheath thing of metal. And even if it was, then you're getting whatever gook you had on the blade on the inside of your sheath, you know, which can lead to rust and things, which is why you'd always clean your blade off before sheathing it. But I'm going to get back right here to reading, and it is page 192, paragraph 3. Move back just a little, please. fair lady, and I shall try to find the means by which it is opened. He said to her, and moved to examine the wall with eye and fingers, "You are keen-eyed and clever indeed, lady." "Thank you, sir," Evelie replied with a small curtsy and a note of cheerfulness in her voice for the first time since this escapade had begun. They were by no means safe, thought Gord. They were still at large and undiscovered. There was now real hope, so long as the rag thing did not regain its unnatural life again. A small stone moved inward under his touch, and as it did so, a small crack widened, revealing and freeing a wide, low panel of rock. By pressing on one end of it, Gord discovered that the panel pivoted around a center post. He pulled on the slab until it stuck into the chamber perpendicular to the curved wall. The opening was not huge, but easily big enough to enable them to pass into a narrow stone tunnel beyond it. Gord took time to reclose and lock the panel in its original place, feeling considerable relief as he did so. Neither the guards nor anything else would have an easy time following their route. Then the pair started to follow the passage that had been concealed behind the secret door, Evelie carrying the lantern and Gord with dagger in hand. After a short distance, the narrow corridor dead-ended at a broader one that led both left and right. Gord opted for the left, saying that they could try the other direction if this one failed to offer something positive soon. Before long, they entered a larger place, pillared and arched, that was the nexus of many tunnels. In addition to the one they had entered from, there were four other passages leading off from the place, and a spiral flight of stone stairs leading upward as well. Gord disliked the sight of the steps, and after a moment of deliberation, he set off to the right, his female companion in tow. "What is this place, Gord?" asked Evelie. "Towns and cities were full of surprises like this," he began. "In addition to sewers, drains, cisterns, caverns, and catacombs, there is a warren of escape tunnels and secret adits, the highways of many who wish not to be seen." "All cities?" Evelie asked incredulously. "I can't speak for all of them, only a few. I've encountered this sort of passage before. It is part of a hidden means of communication and escape from its look, and one that hasn't been neglected either. So let's press on." Like, I was noticing that... I was noticing that there was a strong similarity to the Beggars Union secret at the end there with Theobald and Gord's escape. And here we have that this tunnel seems to be similar to the one that entered below into the sewers underneath the city of Greyhawk that exited from the Beggars Union. And that's obviously what Gord is referring to here. So, here we have note that the elves do indeed, secret and concealed doors are difficult to hide from elves. So we do indeed have a link that Evelie has some kind of elven heritage. And here in the rules for AD&D is a section about elven characters likely are 2 in 6 likely to find a secret door and 50% likely to discover a concealed portal. And as Gord mentions right here, this is a secret door. So the other thing is here we have, about what is below Stoink. That this secret passage is now leading to more of a warren of passages and many directions that could be followed. It seems like this should be pretty close to directly under the Lord Mayor's palace. And we have here many passages leading off and stairs going up. So I'm going to we start here is page 193. It is paragraph 6. Beverly had allowed her pace to flag. At Gord's urging, she picked it up again. We were nearing the end of the passage anyway. After another 10 or 15 steps, it ended at a narrow spiral stairway that had been crudely chiseled from the solid rock. There was a heap of old clothing in a nearby hamper, a sure sign that this passage was still used for something, and Gord stopped for a second to root around in it. After selecting two somewhat dirty and malodorous cloaks, the young man told Evelyn to take her own off and replace it with one of the others. She demurred, but Gord insisted, stating that although hers was now soiled and tattered, its workmanship and quality were still too easily noted. They compromised by locating a garment that fit over the cloak she wore, thus hiding it and adding a bit of some seeming bulk to her slight figure. Break. It kind of surprises me here that Gord so easily goes over and explores a pile of dirty clothing after encountering the ragworm that it just previously. I almost thought that there might be another surprise, or he might stab it first or something.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, he just had that encounter. I mean, he really got lucky with it, too, decapitating it like that.
Yes, I mean, it could be a very low hit die creature, a very lesser powerful one where it was easy to kill. But still, it's, decapitation, and it could have been more powerful, as that's, usually the result of a critical hit, but not something that was particularly in the rules. It could be that, Gygax has been pretty consistent in trying to describe combat in an AD&D sense, so that when he's fighting stronger characters, it's usually not just, one quick thrust and the NPC is killed. Instead, it talks about the back and forth, Gord taking wounds and giving wounds. And that was, I know the creature was just forming, kind of swelling up out of the rags. And I don't think I have heard of it before. So it does seem like something that in the last, 36 years, nobody has, that I know of, has detailed it. But anyway, here Gord is just casually, digging into a thing of old clothes or dirty clothes. Let's see. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 193, and it is the third paragraph from the end. Creeping up the steps with caution, Gord was ready for anything. All he came to was a manure pit. "Ooh," he said involuntarily when he opened the tiny concealed door that led from the spiral staircase to the dung heap. "Now I know why these cloaks stunk so." Evelyn held her nose and grimaced, but stepped ahead as rapidly as her companion did, passing the heaps of manure and bits of rotting straw, and headed for a wooden ladder at the far end of the pit. They moved up again, her scent ending when Gord pushed open a trap door, emerged into a wooden shed containing wheelbarrows, spades and forks, and a small cart. The walls of the shed were old, weathered, and, the walls of the shed were old, weathered, and warped, though here and there holes and cracks could be seen. Gord reached over and shuttered the lantern quickly, keeping only a small slot to cast a little beam of light. By its ray they found the door, which opened at ground level into a stable area of some sort. Gord extinguished the lantern and discarded it, finding the moonlight sky to be sufficient for easy travel. They left the shed behind. As they exited, Gord heard Evelyn draw her first deep breath in some time. After they had left the stable area and walked for a while, the area began to look familiar to Gord. He put off saying anything until he was sure, and then exclaimed happily, "We're in Rat's Wharf. I know this area well. Just up ahead is Tannery Street. Beyond is the Umber Stream. We'll go to our right here and be at the docks in no time." Pike. Now, I kind of feel like I've seriously missing some travelogue here, because Gord's at the Lord Mayor's Palace. They go down, straight down, to the lower floor, and they find this passageway that seems at first like the drainage. Somewhere between there and going to the door that was locked, but that was only a passage of several hundred feet. And then they seem to go up, straight up, and then just outside that where he found the ragworm, it didn't seem like they had traveled very far to go up the stairs and find the manure pit. So I'm just kind of missing that they seem now to have traveled quite a distance to get outside the walls and over to Rat's Wharf, which is one of the suburb village areas beyond the walls of Stoink. And they're now in Rat's Wharf, and it would love to see a map of Stoink. Maybe the Lord Mayor's Palace is very near to Rat's Wharf, and it's just a suburb, because otherwise it seems like they would have been talking about traveling a greater distance.
Yeah, they would have had to somehow come through a tunnel under the walls, right? Because they were definitely in Stoink.
Yeah, now I'm not sure they were in Stoink. I mean, they were at the Lord Mayor's Palace. And I'm not sure if that door that was shut, you know, it was barred on the opposite, and then Gord barred it himself, if that meant that that was a tower along the wall or a tower in the castle. It may have been, I think there was mention that it might have been a tower with on the wall of the castle. So if Rat's Wharf was beyond that, then perhaps getting down to Rat's Wharf was not that great a distance from the walls of the Lord Mayor's Palace. And since we really don't have a map, and he's not really giving us great directions here, we're there, we're here, and you know, we get some clues about direction. It might be simply that the castle area, the Lord Mayor's Palace, that Rat's Wharf is just beyond the walls there. So we're given here that there is the Umber Stream, and we're given some names within Rat's Wharf right here. The Tannery Street and Umber Stream. And I assume that Umber Stream is actually the name of the stream that goes by Rat's Wharf. I don't know offhand if that is something that is marked. Stoink.
There seems to be a stream on Anna's map. I don't remember if I could make out a name for it.
Yeah, I mean, I would have should have listed that in my index about Umber Stream, as it's a proper noun, and I would just say that it sounds like it might be a stream that leads to the Artansame, because I thought Stoink was all the way up, but still part of the Artansame.
It is.
All right, so then the Umber Stream may be a connecting stream, the way that the Grey Run comes off of the Sellet and around the city of Greyhawk. All right, I'm going to restart right here. On page 194, it is paragraph 3. Trying to sound as enthused as he was, Heavily responded, "Yes, I'm free at last. You are my champion, Gord." "Thank you, Evely. but neither you nor I are quit of Boss Daly yet. His writ extends here, and a long way around, too. Now we are about to start on the second stage of our escape." His voice trailed off as they came to the wharf where hides were unloaded. The odor here was unmistakable, too, and actually worse than that of the dung they had recently had to tread across. As the girl made a face and held her nose, Ward pulled her closer to him. At the edge of the wharf, they walked so as to enable him to peer over the side toward the water below. After a bit, he stopped, climbed nimbly down the piling of the pier, and used his foot to pull on a rope tied there. A small skiff attached to the other end appeared under him, and he dropped lightly into the boat. "Quick now," Evely Gord urged. "Sit on the edge of the pier and slide off and into the boat. I'll catch you so we don't capsize." The girl shrugged and complied without further hesitation. After all she had been through this night, what was one little leap into a bobbing cockle shell? Although the skiff rocked violently when she landed, Ward was true to his word, both catching her neatly and maintaining the stability of the small craft. After helping her find a seat in the bow, he moved to the stern and picked up the sweep that was resting there. A few quick pushes and pulls, and Gord had sculled the boat out of the sight of the wharf and into the current. Sculling and the flow of the Artansame soon carried him through the wide rat's pool, where various small ships and barges were moored, and on down the river. Break. All right, here, I guess, is definitely referred to as the Artansame. I'm not quite sure what the Umber Stream is. But here, right away, we have Gord talking about being on the Artansame. And then the other thing is we do get the name that it's called after the Rat's Wharf, the area around them where the ships and barges dock is called the Rat's Pool. So you can imagine that off of the river there's maybe a stream and some kind of area that allows for, you know, where they can dock that doesn't have so much motion in it, you know. And the other thing is that here, Gord is able to use a boat. And this would be because of his time with Renee, because during his time in this city, it's only with staying with Renee and on the wharfs that's mentioned, but you don't really know what happened there. Maybe he learned to use a boat there, or maybe when he was traveling along the near Dev, he had learned to use a boat. Because here, if you're doing a character, it's nice to have that little bit of background. Now, if you're using a rule system that has skills, then you put down, you know, like the character gets to choose so many skills. But either whether it's being done as a particular number of skills you can have and levels of skill level and such, or whether it's just a written thing as character background, it should all have an explanation of where it comes from. So that, you know, like if you're using in game, it can be very quick to just go down and say, well, he knows a little fletching and he knows some, you know, how to look at gems and value them, or, you know, that he has these skills. But whether you're using it as a quick skill system or whether you're using it as a background, it still needs, I think, to have some explanation. Otherwise, you're really missing on some quick detail that adds to the depth of the character and the involvement of the player. So here, without mentioning it, you can see that Gord has an explained background of why he can handle this little boat, you know, right offhand, and then becomes part of their escape. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 195, paragraph 2. Keeping well to the left of midstream, Gord passed the lowering blackness of Stoink's walls and towers without incident. He used the oar mainly to steer now. The current was swift in this area. After an hour, there was still no sign of pursuit. The walled town was far to the north, for the river bent sharply south after passing the place. Someone might eventually put a missing boat together with your escape, lady, but not for some time, I think. Our only really real worry now would be magical assistance in hounding us down. I know little of Diomer craft, and less of how to combat it. For once I come to the rescue, Gord, Evely said with a musical laugh. Of magic and enspellment I know a little, for my dear grandmother, great-great-grandmother, really, taught me some of that art, though nothing potent or useful here. That kind woman did bestow upon me something that will serve us now, I think. Wait, I'll show you. Gord watched the girl shed her cloaks. Golden light of the newly risen sun revealed that she wore tunic and hose of dove gray. Or dressed as a boy, lady. No such youth ever displayed such a figure in those garments, he said. Evely smiled her pleasure at the compliment, kept up her work, tugging here and there at the leather strip girding her narrow waist. From it she drew a flat milky crystal. Look at this, she said proudly, handing it to him. Evident pride and assurance the small stone gave her made Gord examine it closely. He noted that the crystal was carved so as to resemble a bird, with wings folded down as if to shelter something before it. The thing was bound with silver wire, and a silver chain was fastened to it for wearing around the neck. He handed it back to the girl. It is a well-crafted bit of jewelry, lady, but looks to be of no great value, I fear. Aye, it would fetch no more than a few. This is no trinket, Evely interrupted. With more laughter. It is an amulet of power, little Fonkin, a protection against any seeking me by means of spell or Diomer. I see, lady, Gord responded respectfully. Then, with a bit of an edge to his voice, he added, what is this Fonkin you call me? Evely explained with a giggle that it was an elvish term for someone silly or ignorant. Be not offended, Gord, for I employed it only as an endearment, she said sweetly. Now it was Gord's turn to be flattered by her words, and he smiled at her. She returned the smile, meanwhile fastening the chain so the amulet was secured around her neck. The process interested Gord, for the tunic was thin, and when it was drawn tight by her movements, some most interesting details of her anatomy were revealed. Evely seemed not to mind the scrutiny a whit, but Gord was careful not to overdo it. Take a pallet of the cloaks in the bottom of this skiff, Evely, and sleep a bit, he said. I'll steer us carefully, so as to avoid contact with any other craft. The girl started to object, but Gord was firm, and Evely did admit she was very tired indeed. With you out of sight, he added, anyone passing or observing us from the bank will think I'm a fisher, alone, and of no interest. It is the safest way. Right. Well, we get a little bit more of Evely's character and her abilities. Also, her great-great-grandmother sounds like she may be the elvish part of Evely's, that her part of being elvish comes from her. And obviously, here we have an example of a magical item, which in the story so far are exceedingly rare. This story is, we do have the one point back in, I believe it's Lukesh, where there is a dwarf, Hengst, who has several magical items, magical daggers, and possibly other magical items, and sells that dagger that Gord has, the long tooth, relatively cheaply at 6 gold. And then in the rest of the story, we're really not, there may be magic items or there may not, but we're really not encountering many spells or magic weapons, armor, or magic items. So here we have something that is going to allow Evoli to avoid detection. It doesn't say that it would stop Gord from being detected, and I don't know if it's something that comes up later or not. Now, we have our little elven word here, a Funken, and I'm not sure if there wasn't a NPC character from one of the modules that was named Funken. I thought it was Funken Hottie Peak, perhaps, but I can't remember offhand.
I'm not sure. I tried to get a definition on that, and I couldn't. Not really.
Yeah.
Not one that I trust, at least.
There was, you know, one of the modules that had several, you know, names kind of like that, and I don't know. Yes, it is. So, okay. Yeah, Funk and Hottie Peak, and now perhaps then it is not that Funken is not really a name, but, you know, a little... you know, a little nickname added to that character. That's very interesting little tidbit there. I don't believe that I actually added that to the index work that I did as a separate reference. Yeah, Funken Hottie Peak. He's from the D modules, and he's a high elf. So that is very interesting, and I never noted that the word Funken was being used here, and that's definitely something to add, that Funken is silly or ignorant in Elvish. They don't say which language of Elvish, but maybe just a general Elvish term.
So, she doesn't really mean it in a bad way, though. She's using it in a term of endearment, I would think.
Yes, and at least Gord took it that way. I think it's to be noted that Evoli can be a little haughty sometimes. You know, she seems to be, you know, from time to time, she praises Gord quite a bit, but there are several instances where she seems to be you know, a little bit haughty toward Gord, and where, like when Gord rescued her and said that he did not have a plan of escape, but, you know, that kind of was a bit of a justified outrage.
Yeah, I think we said the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it really strikes me that Gord does go to some planning to find her. He does seem nowhere to get to her, but then that whole section of their escape hinges on complete luck, you know, without any plan or idea of where they're going to go or how they're going to escape. That really, I find that incongruous with Gord and the story so far. And I was expecting to hear that he knew, he had seen that there was a secret passage or, you know, or just something that showed some kind of plan. That he was ready to get out of there. I know he said he didn't have time, but he did find out several things, and he did find a way to get to her. Oh, but you're right. That and Gord, for I employed it only as an endearment, she said. So, all right. I'm going to restart here. Is page 196, and it is paragraph 6. Evoli remained asleep through the morning and well into the afternoon. When he was sure no other craft were in sight, Gord allowed himself to doze now and again. He always remained in a sitting position, so that he would not sleep long. Serenity, not fatigue, was making him drowsy. He was young and long accustomed to remaining awake for many hours at a stretch when he had to. As the afternoon shadows lengthened, his companion began to stir and make little moaning sounds. Whether they arose from discomfort from the hard bed or from a dream, Gord knew she would soon awake and would be thirsty and hungry as he was. There was a small tributary of the Artansome at hand, and he sculled the boat into its waters, working hard to pass through the strong flow where the two streams met. When the girl did awaken, a half hour or so later, he had managed to work their skiff well up the creek to a sheltered bank where willows hung down and hid the boat. As the prow bumped against the shore, Beverly sat up and looked around, asking where they were. Ward helped her out of the skiff, and soon both were seated on the soft grass beneath a huge old weeping willow. They were famished, and the dry and tasteless rations that Gord brought forth from a wallet was not much, but it helped to quell the pangs of hunger when washed down with the clear water from the stream at their feet. Gord closed his eyes for a minute, enjoying the comfortable feeling of a full belly and the yielding grass beneath his tired body. A minute became a few minutes, and, "Wake up!" Everly was shaking him gently but urgently. Ward's eyes flew open. It was fully dark, nearly lightless here beneath the willow. He had been asleep for hours. "Listen, Gord, someone is coming." Beverly's tone was filled with fright. "Yes, I hear," he told the girl, taking her arm and squeezing it in reassurance. "We should be safe enough here if we are quiet." Voices and the clopping sound of horses moving slowly came clearly to them on the night breeze. Peering out from the shelter of the drooping branches, Ward saw several riders outlined against the sky. They were heading for the general area of the copse of willows, but not directly at the place where he and Everly were concealed. Soon Ward could count their number and hear what the riders were saying. "Over there, Weasel, see the dead one." "Shit, I ain't blind, Mossback. I'm going for it." "Shut up, you two," a fellow at the end of the file of eight horsemen said sharply. "You'll wake up some white." "Ah, blow it out your ass, Barl. Nobody or nothing in this godforsaken place to hear," Weasel retorted. He rode past, bickering and bantering. About 50 yards farther on, the men dismounted. Although it was a dark night, Gord could discern the goal they had sought. A large dead tree on a small knoll. Whatever business they had there was concluded in an hour or so. They again passed, heading back the way they had come, but traveling silently now. Gordon and Everly stayed put until morning. Penny arose and instructed her to remain hidden. In the early light, it was an easy matter for him to follow the trail the men had left and see where they had stopped. It appeared to be a camp with an old dead fire. Ward knew no such fire had existed the night before, and it immediately occurred to him that the ashes of a fire would be a good place to hide something. Some further examination discovered little else in the area, so he decided to play his hunch. After a few moments of digging with dagger and knife, one of Gord's blades struck metal. More digging brought forth a cache of silver and electrum, far more than was practical for himself and Everly to carry. Gord scooped out several dozen of each type of coin, replaced ashes on top of the remainder, and made the whole look as undisturbed as possible. This find was truly a boon in more ways than one. The 100 gold orbs that had been Gord's share of the loot he and Geller had gained in Haldrun, some had been spent on information and forged documents, and the bulk had been left behind. When he rescued Everly, Gord had with him but 10 of the gold coins. Now he could keep the orbs as security, with plenty of other metal to spend first. Spending of gold attracted attention, and he and the girl must do their utmost to remain unnoticed. Gord returned to Everly and told her briefly of what he had found while helping her back into her hiding place in the bottom of the boat. Everly accepted the unexpected wealth without comment. Noble women thought little of such things, Gord supposed. They took the skiff up the tributary stream for a few more miles, until Gord felt it was safe for them to begin traveling overland. They left the boat moored in a secluded cove on the shore of the stream and followed a rutted dirt track leading due east. Eventually, they came to a hamlet, where they hitched a ride on a farm cart, heading for market in a nearby village. This proved to be a place where they could find horses, so Gord and Evely were soon mounted, well supplied, and traveling on their own again. After a week of hard travel, they finally arrived in Midmeadow, exhausted and dirty, otherwise happy and in excellent spirits. Gord thought he had never been happier, despite the deprivation they had been through, and Evely was radiant. Although they were still in some danger, it was slight, so after discussion they decided to find the best inn, rest and restore themselves, and buy new clothes before setting out again for Evely's homeland in the Blimu Hills. Locating a good inn was a simple matter, and new linens and garments were also easy to come by. Soon the pair were settled in small, clean, and comfortable rooms, luxuriating in great tubs of steaming water provided at considerable cost, but deemed by both well worth the coppers. Evely, looking refreshed and even more radiant now that she was again properly attired, joined Gord in his chamber, where they were served a hot supper and cool wine. Replete, they both sat back, sipped their wine, and smiled at each other. Break. Well, here we cover one of my favorite subjects, is the coinage. It does surprise me that here in Midmeadow, the cost of a hot bath is just called, that it's in coppers. Well, if you recall, all the way back in the city of Greyhawk at the beginning of the story, Gord and Sam, when they go to the university district, they are able to rent their upstairs of the inn for only 4 coppers a month. So that is, it might be, differing values and such, but here that is a bit of a difference, that they're getting 2 hot baths coppers, when back in the city of Greyhawk he gets a month's lodging for 4 coppers. I don't know if the coinage value is changing in Gygax's mind, or whether he's consciously thinking that the coin value isn't the same. It does seem strange that the big city of Greyhawk would have lesser costs than out here in Midmeadow.
Well, aren't they getting the rooms too, not just the bath?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, soon the pair were settled in comfortable rooms, but both. Well, yes, that is possible. I mean,
it makes a little more sense. It's still expensive.
Does. Yeah, because I really don't think that the values should be more, unless they're really being heavily gouged. It would seem like the more you're out into the wilderness and countryside and passing villages and stuff, and Midmeadow itself, I don't believe, is more than a town.
No, it's a city, at least. I think.
What
it's
is it?
I looked it up. I think it has, the website said 11,000, but that's, I don't know about that, but he's been in Midmeadow before on this trip. I forget.
Yeah, but just a brief mention, I think, of passing through.
Right.
Yeah. Now, where, do you remember offhand where Midmeadow is located?
I think it's in Nirond.
All right,
yeah,
so he's
it's
already
in Nirond.
Which makes sense, because with the business of villages and hamlets and sounding rather peaceful, that they have managed to get out of that area. And then we have a little tidbit from before, because there hasn't been anything particularly noteworthy. Midmeadow population, wow, that seems pretty big.
And I don't know that this is, a reputable site, but I'm just, pulling stuff off the internet. So.
Sure, and over here in the Greyhawk fiction, text page, If you go look at where we're talking, July 5th, 2021, you'll see a little listing of populations, and it shows Mid-Meadow population 11,100. So it is
better.
That is a major bit of a, not a major, but a fairly sized city when you have several of them described as only having like 14,000. I think Verbabank only has about 14,000 population. So this definitely is a small city.
Yeah, it's the smallest of the cities that are listed for Nirond here, at least.
Yeah, and of course, Nirond is going to have bigger cities. You know, it's also one of the areas that is, you know, a rather secure area. So there, here we are, they're back into Nirond. But I wanted to mention is that there's the little tidbit with Weasel and Mossback and Barl.
Oh, they started talking like the 1920s again.
Yes. And Gord was actually starting to sound a little, when he waxes poetic about Evely, he starts talking in like, you know, really fantasy medieval again. But here we have a little gang, little group of somebodies hiding treasure in the middle of the wilderness. It just, and really not in a particularly, not particularly great place, it sounds like. You know, I mean,
in ashes.
Ashes, which could be rained away or blown away, and also where somebody else traveling through, it's a noted place with a hillock and a dead tree by it and a campsite, and it's good to camp on a raise in elevation for several reasons, even a small one, because if you've done, you know, any camping, that if you're raised up above the surrounding area, your campsite isn't going to be as wet. You know, it's just simply that if you camp in a low area, you're camping in mud. And if you're camping raised up, it can be wet, but it's definitely not as wet as the area below it. So it sounds like it's a decent campsite, and people might come and, set a fire there right on your treasure. I doubt any fire like that would be hot enough to melt things, but silver has particularly low melting point. So, you know, it seems very odd that they would just casually put it there and not like bury it deep or, and it is a little interesting thing there that here we have this unexplained story, what Weasel and, Mossback and Barl were up to there. And I don't know if we ever hear from them or about them again, but it's one of the things I do love about these, stories and about the early Greyhawk stuff and what they did, you know, later, is to have these little bits that you could expand upon. And so you could expand upon these NPCs and their little group and practically come up with any story that you want. We don't know anything about them. They could be bandits, they could be spies, they could be adventurers. And then, like you were saying, their vernacular is, again, like early 1920s. That one comment was, that particular favorite from that time period. We're getting close to the end of the night here. I am going to restart. It is page 199, and we are on paragraph 3. Gord, at last I feel truly free, Evely sighed. Free of that bandit pig who calls himself a noble sovereign. Free of his confinement. Free of threat of slavery, and I owe it all to you. Evely's violet eyes were warm. Her long hair, the color of spun platinum, was free, flowing across her shoulders and down her back. The gown she wore this night was new. A simple one of silk and snowy hue, embroidered at neckline, cuff, and hem with flowery designs. She had caught the waist with a satin sash the color of her eyes. It seemed to Gord that no living woman could be this lovely, this unaffected. Her every line and curve he had memorized, and tonight, clad as she was, The memories came rushing back, unbidden but not unwelcome. A glimpse of bare back and arm as she splashed cold stream water in the morning, a leg revealed in walking or riding. All wonderful memories indeed. My part is small, lady, and for it you owe me nothing. Lord told her sincerely, eyes locked on hers. What true man could have done otherwise? Don't be a Fonkin again, Gord. Many men helped to put me into that pig's toils. Others imprisoned me, while still other men sought to use me by trickery, flattery, or sheer purchase. You did risk all for me, Gord, and I owe you my very life. He took her delicate hand in his, saying, If you insist, I shall accept credit, but only for a duty begun, not completed. We have come 50 leagues, but there are 5 times that number betwixt you and Nurl, and who can say how many dangers yet overcome? Break. All right, now here we have, that 50 leagues, that is, Gygax cans out some distances and directions, and every so often, and here we have dropped in that from Stoink to Midmeadow is 50 leagues. And then from Midmeadow to Nurl is supposed to be 250 leagues. So from Nyrond up to Nurl there. Now, that does give us, there is a map here that we have on the Greyhawk Fiction text channel, and it does show Midmeadow and Stoink. And it gives you a good idea. Then it puts the map at about across probably close to 60 leagues across, I'd say. And that then puts a lot of the things we've been encountering in this story within measurable distance of right here. Given that that's right, that's an added little touch there that can tell you, we can trace a map of Gord's progress. One of the things I would like to do is to have a little map of, take the map of the Flinnes and have like a little dotted line map of Gord's travels that show him going up and back and forth and Stoink over to, Midmeadow and his travels with the Atloy. I think that'd be a very enjoyable little map, especially because Gord, in these stories, does a lot of traveling across the Flinnes.
Yeah, quite a bit.
That, of course, is one of the great things about this book, that Gygax is filling in bits and pieces of geography and detail as we're going along in this story. And here's another one. Now, we are on page 199, so we're done, I believe, gone through the Stoink description, and there is probably as much time spent, there's much pages spent in Stoink as there were in the City of Greyhawk. Whether or not there's been a great deal of action, though, more so than even in the earlier part of the book. There's been a great deal here with Evelyn, and that goes a little quicker, because the more action there is, there really is not as much to comment about. All right, we have Fonkin used again. I'm very surprised that I wasn't able to note it in my index, and this is an enjoyable little discovery with Fonk and Hottie Peak and finding out what his name means. So I'm very pleased with pulling that out of these books right here. We are not, there really isn't much about Gord or Evely that seems new or surprising right here. And Gord is still very, in love with Evely here. And seemingly in a very, heroic or young, young way that is mostly romance. All right, we're very near the end. I'm going to start right here, though, and it is page 199, the last paragraph. You are my savior nonetheless, Gord. I happily place my safety and welfare in your hands. As she spoke, the girl rose from her chair, prompting Gord to do likewise. Just as I place my person in your arms now, she moved to him, and there was no resisting such an offer. Gord eagerly clasped his arms around her little waist as his lips sought hers. They were indeed as soft and wonderful as their looks had promised, and their kiss lasted and grew more passionate as the two allowed its sensations to fill their beings. Gord's hands moved of their own volition, going here and there to explore and affirm the girl, and the fact that he held her thus. Heavily made no protest, only kissing him more passionately than before, and allowing her own small hands to discover what they could have gored. Although neither directed it, both were soon disrobed and prone upon the yielding down of the bed's expanse. Kisses gave way to nibbles, soft bites and rapid breathing. Evely, oh Evely, I give you my soul. You have mine already, Gord, my champion. Tell me that you love me. And I'm going to end right here. It is page 200 and the end of chapter 19. Not much more than a little and the comment here is bad move, young lady. There's something, and Gord is particularly naive about women, so it is, you know, it is one of the few described interactions he's had here, and the you know, his relationship, and he's never had a good relationship, so you know, just reading into the future, it's perhaps not a good sign, but That is the, I believe, the conclusion of our stoink portion of the story. And they're now in Midmeadow, and like they said, you know, like forecasting, we're moving into the next stage. So I believe we get into a lot more detail in the upcoming chapters, and there'll be a lot more, and we're moving into a very interesting area. Now, stoink, I don't know why, as I've read this many times before, but it never impressed me before how exciting an area stoink is for adventure. In some senses, you know, there's a huge amount to be done in the City of Greyhawk. And again, you can find things even to do in Lukesh, Radikas City, Carpona, that are all lightly detailed in this, but this stoink, really, it's also, stoink is a good entranceway if you want to do a military campaign, because here we have the whole outer area is about mercenaries and tribes and bandit gangs, and immediately there's talk about the bandit kingdoms that are under the captured, or there's warfare going in from the Horn Society in the west to the Tenna and the Pale in the east. There's at least five of the bandit kingdoms that have been taken over. Grosscroft, Redspan, and the two, what was it, Warfield and Worms something or other in the west by the hierarchs of the Horn Society. And so there is possibilities for different kinds of adventure that can really be centered in stoink, that you can have the mercenary adventure, the warfare, the siege adventure, not overpoweringly big, but right here that we've been talking about and looking at in the story, stoink is a really interesting setting area.
Yeah, it's a great place, and I don't remember it going into this much depth the first time I read it.
Yeah, well, it's partly like noticing that little bit, like Fonkin, that is an Elvish name, that know, that's, we've been pulling apart the book, and I think that when you realize what Gygax detailed and what he just passed through quickly, you realize what he was thinking when there's talk about Gygax of wanting to come out with a Stoink supplement. When I first heard that, I was like, why? But now I can see what Gygax was thinking. And, you know, it's a bandit kingdom. It's right up there with some of the major adventures like White Plume Mountain. It's just an area where there is room for all kinds of adventure and differing kinds of adventure than you run into around the city of Greyhawk, because you're very unlikely around there to run into major mercenary kind of adventuring right out of the city. You could, but here we have right around it, you know, right around Stoink, there's things to go up against. You have a fairly evil you know, dictator and Boss Daly. You have, you know, you could infiltrate the city, and it's an open city, and it has people of all different sorts. They have the merchants coming in, they have their own exports and craftsmen. The city itself, in the walls, seems relatively peaceful. So if you're an adventurer out there, and you have a lot of loot, say, it seems like Stoink would be the perfect place to come and dispose of the loot. And, you know, there must also, besides loot, be lots of things that you could buy in Stoink. You know, especially because of all that stolen and trade goods coming in, that you might be able to get, you know, come there as a, like, mid-level adventurers and discover all these things that, you know, you could actually turn your treasure in for. You know, I don't know if you'd find, like, schools of wizardry or anything, but you probably find a lot of magical artifacts, and at least on the middle or low level. Stoink just seems to be a real treasure trove for adventure ideas. Right.
Yeah, it definitely does.
All right, we've hit the end of the night, and it's going to be one of... there's a 7:30 show on Jake's Lord Gazumba that I'd like to listen to. So I'm going to call Craig in here, and this will be good night for recording number 26.